Welcome to the History Podcast, guys. This is your host, Jason Thomason. Let's get started. Welcome to the podcast, guys. Today we're going to talk about probably one of my favorite decades in American history, and we're going to focus primarily on the presidents that served in the White House during that decade. And we're going to talk about the 1920s. And the 1920s is an era where the music is awesome. You have jazz music really taking off in the 1920s. You also see country western kind of take off during the 1920s. It's also the era of prohibition. If you think back to the previous episodes, we talked about the 18th Amendment, and this is the decade where prohibition will be in full effect. It's ineffective in the sense that it doesn't stop people from making it, distributing it, or drinking it. We have speakeasies, which are these underground clubs that are going in major cities. They're underground in the sense that they're in the basement of certain buildings where everyone knows they exist. Everyone seems to be attending them and having a good time, listening to jazz music, drinking and smoking at these locations. Police officers know that it's going on, yet it continues. And I think that kind of tells you how arbitrary the 18th Amendment was in terms of its enforcement. You had law enforcement who would tend to look the other way, especially when it related to crime families. This is the decade where we see the rise in major crime families who are going to distribute this moonshine, as we call it, on the black market. Guys like Al Capone, one of the most notorious mobsters in American history, is making a fortune off of selling illegal alcohol. Another guy is Lucky Luciano. And there's many others that are going to rise from prohibition. And it just goes to show you that it is ineffective. You're not stopping people from drinking. In fact, President Harding, which is one of the presidents we're going to talk about in the 1920s, he was notorious for having poker games in the White House where he would gamble a lot. In fact, he gambled so much that he lost a priceless set of chinaware, White House chinaware that he didn't buy, obviously, and he gambled it away. And he was well known for drinking a lot during these games. So the president of the United States is drinking this illegal alcohol, but it's a law that you can't drink alcohol. It makes no sense. And again, it just goes to show you how arbitrary the 18th Amendment was. We're also going to see a lot of fashion trends change. We're going to see younger women dressing differently, acting differently. The young women of the 1920s were known as flappers. They wore their dresses shorter. They came up to their knees. They exposed their shoulders. They wore their hair shorter. They wore a lot of makeup. They smoke and drank. They went to these speakeasies at night and left their parents wondering what in the world is happening to our girl. This is also a period where we'll see a renaissance in places like Harlem, New York. In fact, specifically speaking, the Harlem Renaissance, where you're going to see African-American culture kind of take hold of its heritage. You're going to see African-American art and music and dance and culture really take off, along with jazz music, during this decade. Consumerism during the 1920s is going to take off. The consumerist market is really taking off because of Henry Ford's assembly line, which not only affected the automobile industry. The Model T is going to become a very affordable vehicle where the middle-income American can save up a few months' wages and purchase a Model T, take his family out on Sunday afternoon drives. But it's also going to change the manufacturing and production of household appliances. This is the decade where we really start to see Americans buying household products that you and I take for granted today. But in the 1920s, American women in particular, which was the target audience, saw appliances that they once thought were impossible to afford. Now they can afford them because of the assembly line, which makes production rates go, or production costs go down, making it more affordable on the market. From a sports standpoint, what's really cool is this is where you see baseball really become America's pastime. Baseball is a very popular sport already going into the decade, but in the 1920s, baseball is really kind of establishing itself as America's pastime. You're also going to see professional football come about in the 1920s. From a societal standpoint, from a political standpoint, America is fresh off the heels of World War I, and quite frankly, the majority of Americans are exhausted with all that is going on in Europe, all the entanglements that they felt we got ourselves into, and they don't want to be a part of the rebuild of Europe. They don't want to be caught up in future alliances. We already talked about how the League of Nations failed, that Woodrow Wilson proposed. They don't want to get caught up in all of that because they just fear that by becoming a member of an organization like the League of Nations or any other future alliances, that if one of those members got themselves in a bind, we would have to step in and go fight. And we saw the devastation of World War I, and Americans don't want to be a part of that. Having said all of that, after World War I, we are no longer just a world power. We have moved from just a world power after the Spanish-American War to a creditor nation. Before World War I, we were seen as a debtor nation because we owed a little over $1 billion to our allies, the English and the French. After World War I, people owe us somewhere in the ballpark, depending on which economist you believe, in the ballpark of $4 and $6 billion. And so our ascendancy as a world power is continuing. But domestically speaking, Americans don't want to mess with foreign policy. They want to return to isolationism. They don't want to get entangled. I hate to beat that word to death, but they don't want to get themselves entangled in future conflicts. Nobody is going to capitalize better on this mindset than Warren G. Harding in the election of 1920. Warren G. Harding is a guy who didn't really want to run in 1920. He enjoyed the laid-back nature of his position as a senator, but it was because of his wife's strong encouraging, much like Taft and even Cleveland before that, who really wanted to become first lady. He nicknamed her the Duchess, and he was quoted as saying, "What the Duchess wants, the Duchess gets." Many believe that she kind of pulled the strings in terms of convincing him to run. And she's also going to play a major role in the campaign season, because what we have now in 1920 is a new demographic of voter that the country has never had before. And that is women. This is the first presidential election since the passing and ratification of the 19th Amendment. And so both parties, Republicans and Democrats, who have spent decades upon decades upon decades turning their nose up at women, now have to figure out a way to reverse course, to attract them to their party. And nobody in 1920 played their cards better than Warren G. Harding's wife. She hit the campaign trail, attracting women to the Republican Party, convincing them that Warren G. Harding, her husband, was the candidate for women. Harding's going to run on a campaign slogan of a return to normalcy. And I think that this is an important campaign slogan. It's very strategic. You have to think about what the country's been through. We got ourselves involved in World War I. Before that, we were involved in the Spanish-American War. And a lot of Americans believe that we are overextending ourselves, and we need to refocus on what's going on at home. return to isolationism, is another way of putting it. He was quoted as saying, America's present need is not heroics, but healing. No nostrums, which nostrums is another word for medicines or remedies, but normalcy. Return to normalcy. We've heard in recent campaigns, make America great again. You know, this is the same kind of mantra, same kind of slogan. Return to normalcy. Focus on America first. Don't worry about what's going on globally. Worry about what's going on domestically. His campaign platform is going to be one that is what we kind of think of in terms of modern Republican agendas, and that is lower taxes, which you have to keep in mind. The 16th Amendment is in full effect. It's been in full effect for quite some time. And Americans are starting to feel the angst of the income taxes. And this is a constant debate now. He's going to push for lower taxes, including income taxes, and higher tariffs. You have to understand why he wanted higher tariffs. Higher tariffs means that Americans will be more discouraged to do business outside of the country, which will in turn help promote American business. The problem with this is one that I think we failed to kind of talk about a lot. We're still fresh off the heels of World War I. The British and the French owe us a lot of money. Well, their economies are still recovering from war, and they can't pay that money back without American business. But if Americans are too afraid to pay the tariff, well, they're not going to do business with those countries, and instead will stay at home. And so what we have is a situation where the British and the French, who are losing business because of higher tariffs in the United States, being unable to pay back what they owe from World War I. And we'll address this more here in just a little bit. Harding is very pro-business, and he is also going to focus on isolationism from a foreign policy standpoint. The biggest legacy that Harding is going to leave, however, is the fact that he is going to appoint probably the worst cabinet in American history. Now, I know today in modern politics, we may have some that disagree, but only time will tell on that one. But right now, currently, what we know, this administration that served under Harding is probably the most corrupt administration in American history. He hired a bunch of people that he considered political allies. These guys were cronies. These guys were not necessarily qualified for the jobs that they were going to hold. And because of that, they're going to participate in very illegal dealings with or without his knowledge. Now, he will always maintain that he had no knowledge of what was going on. This group of cronies that serves as the president's cabinet will become historically known as the Ohio Gang. And, you know, the most notorious event that takes place in the Harding administration is the Teapot Dome scandal. And the Teapot Dome scandal is something that takes place with the Secretary of the Interior. His name is Albert Fall. And Albert Fall is going to illegally take protected government land. And specifically, this is land where we keep our military's oil reserves in Wyoming. And he's going to take it under his control illegally. And what he's going to start doing is selling it off the books to some of his oil friends in the private industry. He's going to make somewhere in the ballpark of $400,000. You know, you have to understand that's in the 1920s. He's going to make somewhere in the ballpark of $400,000 off of these sales. When this hits the papers, Harding is going to do what any president is taught to do, or any politician for that matter, deny, deny, deny. Fall will take, no pun intended, he will take the fall for this. And he will become the first, and this is a big deal, he's going to become the first cabinet member in American history to not only have to resign his post because of illegal activities, but he's going to be the first to have to, not have to, but he's going to be the first to be arrested and sent to prison. He will serve time in jail for his activities in the Teapot Dome scandal. What else is interesting to note on this, and as much as Harding denied any knowledge of what went on, two of his family members committed suicide over this incident. And, you know, while we can't directly connect Harding to the Teapot Dome scandal, it does seem odd that two of his family members who were known to be involved in the Teapot Dome scandal end up committing suicide. Seems pretty convenient. But nonetheless, somehow he survives impeachment. If we wanted to talk about a successful dealing with Harding during his time in office, he did get the Kellogg brand pact agreed upon. Now, it won't be signed while he's in office, but he's going to get 15 of the world's powers to agree to reduce and disarm their navies, and also essentially outlaw war, which is ridiculous because how are you going to outlaw war? And while the intention of the pact, which we call the Kellogg brand pact, is something to be admired, I mean, how are you going to stop someone from going to war? It's an enforceable law. I mean, you cannot enforce this policy. It's impossible. Another bill that will be proposed is how to get reparations after World War I. And this will take place during the Harding administration. It's known as the Dawes Plan. Not the Dawes Act, which dealt with Native Americans in the 1880s, but the Dawes Plan. The Dawes Plan is going to deal with Germany. Germany is in a great deal of debt, and Germany does not have the money to pay war reparations to England and France. Well, here's the other issue. England and France don't have the money, economically, to pay us for all of what we loaned them during World War I. So here was the plan by Dawes. Dawes's plan was this, and men like J.P. Morgan Jr., who was the son of J.P. Morgan, who died in 1913, the mega financier of the country, they were all on board with this. Big business would loan, and the government would loan, somewhere in the ballpark of $2.5 billion to Germany. And then Germany would take that $2.5 billion and turn around and pay it to the Allies. Now, you may be wondering, why is this a big deal? Because what's going to happen is the French and the English will take that $2.5 billion and then they will pay it back to the United States. The issue that we're seeing, why this was necessary, is because we have a president who is very laissez-faire, which means he is very pro-business. He wants to raise tariffs. He wants to lower taxes. He wants to keep business in-house. But those high tariffs have prevented business from being done with the English and the French. So it is a necessity that you get the Germans to pay off the Allies, because without them being able to pay off the Allies, they're not going to be able to turn around and pay us back. Harding is going to die of a heart attack in 1923. He will serve from 1921 into parts of 1923, and he will die of a heart attack. And his vice president, Calvin Coolidge, will assume the office and finish his term. In recent years, I say recent years, in like the 70s, there was, if you believe in conspiracies, which I try to stay away from, but there are those who prescribe to conspiracy theories that believe that his wife may have poisoned him, causing him to go into cardiac arrest. You see, Warren G. Harding was not only a well-known gambler and drinker, he was also a well-known womanizer. And it is believed that she stumbled upon letters from one of the women that Harding had been with and decided she was going to kill him. But there is no proof of that without a shadow of a doubt. So it's all speculation and conspiracy. But there are those out there who kind of believe that maybe she had something to do with it. Nonetheless, he dies of a heart attack and Coolidge assumes the office. What is interesting is that there are some comparisons. There are some correlations between Warren G. Harding and the Clinton administration. And just to name a few, and they're kind of eerie how similar some of these are. Both were extremely charismatic guys. They were very well spoken. They looked presidential. They carried themselves in a way that drew people in. They both had an interest in the saxophone. They both played the saxophone very well. They were both womanizers, as we kind of know from history, and they were both involved in presidential scandals that caused the public to begin to distrust the office of the presidency even more. So Harding dies, and Calvin Coolidge will assume the office of the presidency in 1923. And if Harding was the charismatic president that everybody kind of was attracted to, and he drew them in, Calvin Coolidge is the antithesis, much in the same way that Teddy Roosevelt and Taft kind of were, the antithesis of each other personality-wise. Coolidge, his nickname was Silent Cal because he was a man of very few words, and he liked it that way. He was also known for being a big-time sleeper, sometimes even falling asleep in cabinet meetings, but he got his fair share of sleep during his administration. Coolidge believed very strongly in big business. He believed that business was a vital component to the American system and that free enterprise was the lifeblood of America. He was quoted as saying, and in fact, this was on his campaign in 1924. The business of America is business. And he believed very strongly in that. And he didn't defer, to other people. He believed that the government's responsibility was to stay as far away from overregulation as possible, to not interfere, that it wasn't within his power to interfere with the economy, much in the same line that we've seen in the Gilded Age. And it's funny how the pendulum swings. We talk about the pendulum a lot in history. I think that's maybe an overused analogy in American history. But you go back to the Gilded Age. The Gilded Age was very laissez-faire, hands off the economy, and big business rose and the economy did well. And then the economy crashes, and we had two crashes in 73 and 93. And then you have the progressive movement, and the progressive era takes a very hands-on approach with Teddy, with Taft, and with Wilson. Then we go to war, we come out of war, and Americans are tired of dealing with foreign affairs and they want to focus on what's going on inside the country. And so what we see in the 1920s, starting with Harding and now with Coolidge, is a very hands-off approach. Remember that term, laissez-faire, hands off the economy. If the Constitution does not tell us specifically that we can do it, we're not going to do it. And in their interpretation of the law, it doesn't allow them to overregulate the economy, so they're going to stay out of it. One of my favorite stories with Calvin Coolidge, who really had a pretty uneventful term or administration. He finishes Harding's term, he wins his own term in 24. A pretty uneventful 5.5 years or five, well, 4.5 years. But my favorite story for Calvin Coolidge is at a dinner party. And he was a man of very, very few words. It was well known. And it was so bad that his wife was always worried that guests would take it the wrong way. And, being a shy person kind of myself, I kind of relate with Calvin, and but his wife was so worried that people would take it the wrong way that before one of these dinner parties, she kind of was telling people where they were going to sit at this formal dinner, and she was letting the lady that was going to sit next to her husband, hey, you're going to sit next to my husband, and I'm sorry, I'm going to let you know right up front, you're not going to get very much out of him tonight. And So as the story goes, one of the women there overheard this conversation and then made a bet with Calvin. Okay, so they get to the dinner. She makes a bet. She, you know, the drinks are flowing, and so she's feeling pretty confident, and she says to the president, "Mr. President, I bet you by the end of the night, I'll get you to say more than two words." And she kind of laughs, you know, and everybody at the dinner is kind of laughing uncomfortably. And Calvin is eating his dinner, and he kind of sets his fork down, dabs his mouth with his napkin, and looks up at the lady. And all he says is, "You lose." And he goes back to eating his dinner. And that was Calvin Coolidge. That was Silent Cal. He was just a man of very few words. He didn't feel the need to hear himself speak. But, you know, if there are some positives that we can look at with Calvin Coolidge, he was the president that will sign the Kellogg brand pact that we talked about in the Harding administration. The only problem is, how in the world are you going to ever enforce a pact like that, outlawing war? It's impossible. But I think the real legacy of Calvin Coolidge in the context of the 1920s is that he had a pretty uneventful 4 years, which for the Republican Party was a good 4 years because, you know, they had just gotten out of an administration that was just rocked with scandal after scandal after scandal. And for Coolidge to kind of recover the reputation of the Republican Party, I think you can look at that from a political standpoint and say that his administration was a success because he revived the Republican Party. He kind of regained the public trust in the Republican Party, which had been damaged due to Warren G. Harding and the Teapot Dome scandal specifically. But there are some issues going on right now that start in the 1920s, in the early part of the 1920s. And as we get to the midpoint of the 1920s, and especially as we get towards the tail end of the 1920s, it is starting to come to a head, and that is overspending. Americans, especially on Wall Street, are buying more and more stock. And they're buying it on margin, which is essentially credit. They don't have the money up front. They have enough for a down payment. So say you put 10% down and they figure, well, this company is a shoe-in to make me money. I'll be able to pay off the 90% in no time, and I'll also be able to come out of this thing with money on the back end. Stock prices are going to soar from 1927 to 1928, and some of that is an illusion. It's not to say that businesses weren't doing great, because businesses were doing great. This is a consumeristic market. But a lot of these stocks were overinflated. They were overvalued because people were buying them. So people assumed that these companies were doing really, really, really well. And that just wasn't the case across the board. And so as stocks rose because of demand, we start to see profit for business owners skyrocket because people are investing in their company. You know, during the decade of the 1920s alone, business owners saw a 300% increase in wealth, a 300% increase in wealth in the 1920s alone. However, the working class saw wages go up roughly 10%, which is an improvement. But when you see that gap, which we've already talked about the rich and poor gap during the Gilded Age, and we talked about even the rich and poor gap during, you know, the Progressive Era. But even after World War I, we are seeing this gap increase between rich and poor. We see a 300% increase in wealth in the business owners during the 1920s and a 10% increase gap in the working class in the 1920s. And most economists believe that this gap that we see is what drove us into the Great Depression. And by the time we get to 1929, obviously you guys that are fans of history know that in 1929, we will have the stock market crash, which will lead us into the Great Depression of the 1930s. But there's another group that I want to address as we kind of wrap up this episode, and that is the farmer. And we've talked a lot about the farmer in previous episodes and how they are trying to keep up to the demand of food. The problem is the more they make, the more they harvest, rather, the more the prices will plummet. Now, when we're in war, during the Great War, World War I, it's okay to produce a lot because the government incentivizes you to produce more. But the war is over and you still have all this excess land and you have all this excess crop that you should be burning off. You shouldn't be growing and harvesting this much food any longer in a peacetime America. But they continue to do it. And this is a problem because the prices of food are plummeting. And the farmer is running themselves deeper and deeper and deeper into debt, paying off all the machinery, all the land, the mortgages on the homes. They can't keep up. Plus, we're not even taking into account fertilizer and shipping costs, storage costs. I mean, there's more going out than there is coming in, and it's been that way since the Gilded Age. The government in the mid-1920s will try something out. Now, they don't do it to the fullest extent that they should have, and we won't see it done by the government to the fullest extent that it should be done until we get into the Great Depression and FDR creates the AAA, and we'll talk about that in future episodes. But the government is going to try to incentivize farmers to burn off, to destroy excess surplus goods, okay? But because they didn't go far enough in demanding that they do it so that prices go up, incentivizing them with more money, it was really ineffective, and it was too little too late. And so we are going to see farmers just take a plunge into the abyss as we go into the 1930s. And if you've read The Grapes of Wrath, which is one of my favorite books of all time, historically speaking, you know the plight of the farmer that's going to take place in the 1930s. John Steinbeck does a tremendous job of showing the devastation of farmers in the 1930s and because of not only the Great Depression, but because of the Dust Bowl and things like that. Heading into 1928, the Republicans will put up a new nominee. Coolidge will not run again. And in 1928, Herbert Hoover will win the presidency. And Herbert Hoover is just like the other two Republicans of the 1920s. He is very laissez-faire. He believes in pro-business. He's probably a little less laissez-faire than the other two. He does believe that the government does need to kind of regulate certain areas, especially with farmers, that they need to kind of reduce production so that crop prices will rise. Once we get into the Great Depression, after the stock market crashes during his administration, he will promote an ideal of rugged individualism, which we'll kind of touch on when we get into that period. But he's going to win in 1928. Herbert Hoover is a very successful businessman. And what's always kind of sad to me about the legacy of Herbert Hoover is that we always tag the Great Depression with Herbert Hoover. And I think that's unfair. I really do. I think that that's unfair to associate the Great Depression and all the negative aspects of the Great Depression with Herbert Hoover, because he wins in 1928, but he does not take the oath of office until January of 1929. And, you know, so he takes office in 1929, and then in October of 29, that's when the stock market crashes. And then we take the nosedive into the Great Depression, and you know, banks and businesses start going belly up and people lose jobs everywhere. 25% of the country will, by 1933, be without work. But was that really his doing? Now, you could argue that he didn't handle it well. His response to the Great Depression may be fair game for criticism. But to blame the Great Depression on Herbert Hoover, who had only been in office for a couple of months, I think is truly, truly, truly unfair. And I will stand by that. We hope that you enjoyed this podcast. We will pick up with Herbert Hoover and the Great Depression in our next episode, kind of flowing into the longest reign of a president in FDR. after that. If you liked the episode, I ask that you give us feedback. If you hated the episode, I ask that you give us feedback. Any kind of feedback you want to give us, I ask that you give us feedback on all the podcasts, and also ask that you would subscribe to the podcast so that you can get updates anytime we get a new podcast pushed out. So thanks for joining us. And as always, guys, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. See you next time.